Hi. So the point of this talk is that often in kernel space you want to delay some work you're doing until later. There's lots of reasons you might want to delay some work until later. It might be that you want to call a sleeping function and you're in a context where you can't sleep. It might be that you've got a lock held and you want to say, okay, I'll do this work later. Let me just take it off this queue of work to do, and I'll drop the lock, and then I'll go away and do this work. Another might be that you want to batch work in order to amortize the cost of going and taking locks and doing all this work all at once. There's three main ways of doing this, and I'm going to go into each of them in different parts of the talk. Bottom halves, timers, and then task queues, which turned into work queues. I'm going to start by giving you a bit of background, a bit of terminology more like. We've got that there's three basic kernel contexts. That is, contexts that code can be executing in, and each has different properties. First off, process context. Process context is work that's being done on behalf of a process directly. So any syscall you make, the code which executes your syscall in the kernel is executing in process context. We have interrupt context, and when a device asserts an interrupt and you enter the interrupt handler, any code that interrupt handler calls is executing in interrupt context. And the third is bottom half context. And this is kind of a state between the two. It doesn't have a process attached to it directly, so it can't access user space, it can't sleep. But neither is it running in interrupt context. It's running with interrupts enabled. It can be interrupted by other code at any point. Yeah. And locking. Got locking. Everyone knows what a spin lock is, right? Right. See. If you just spin lock, then you're locking against other code that's in process context. If you spin lock IRQ save, then what you're also doing is disabling interrupts, and so you're locking against any code which might be running in interrupt context. Let's say, sorry, you disable interrupts on the local CPU, and you take the spin lock which protects you from other CPUs. There's a new kind of spin lock, the spin lock BH. And this protects you against other bottom halves. Or it protects you against bottom halves in general. And that leaves interrupts enabled. It just prevents other bottom halves from coming in and doing work. So if you have a data structure, because you all know that you lock data, not code, right? If you're locking the data structure, it's only accessed from within a bottom half and from process context. When you're in process context, you can simply call spin lock BH, and that will prevent a bottom half from getting access to your data structure. And if, when you're in bottom half context and you're accessing the data, you call spin lock because you can't be preempted by any other bottom half. And the fourth one of these is, of course, a per CPU data structure. You don't need any locking against other CPUs, but you do still need to lock against other bottom halves running on your CPU and against interrupts running on your CPU. So it really depends what you're trying to protect against. If you don't know, if you haven't figured this out, use spin lock IRQ save and you'll be fine. What I'm talking about is basically for optimization. Question? Ah, right. I'm getting to that later. This is just the introduction. We're getting to bottom halves in a minute. In fact, right now. So I started with why use bottom halves. I think perhaps I should go into a bit more what is a bottom half. This terminology comes from the really early days of Unix. It's not a concept that's unique to Linux at all. It's been in since at least V7 and probably a long time before that. Basically, you don't want a driver to do too much processing in interrupt context. Various reasons. Question? the comment was that it's done slightly different in the bottom half is the interrupt context in traditional Unix. So I guess Linux does do it differently after all. I'm sorry, I should have researched that better. Okay. So the bottom half the bottom half runs after an interrupt has happened. And generally when it runs is on the way back from handling the interrupt, just before you go back to the thing you interrupted, we go and run the bottom halves. And the point is that interrupts are enabled while you're running the bottom half so that other stuff can happen. Because a lot of interrupt handlers will be running with interrupts disabled. So if you've got something like a serial port, which needs a certain number of interrupts a second and doesn't have very deep FIFOs, then you might start dropping characters. So an old style bottom, back in Linux 2.2, we had what are now called old style bottom halves. And they could only run on, only one CPU could be running any bottom half at a time. And this proved to be a problem. Some of you may remember around about April 99, there was a company called Mindcraft who ran a performance comparison on a four-way server between NT and Linux. And they ran those tests, they're basically networking tests, Apache and Samba. And Linux sucked. And the reason Linux sucked is that our network layer wasn't very scalable. It was running underneath a big kernel lock, and so Dave Miller said, right, and went off to fix it. And he fixed the networking layer, and it was all very scalable, multi-threaded, fine-grained, little locks, great. Except that it wasn't good enough, because our bottom half layer was still allowing only one bottom half to run at a time. And the network was one of the network stack was part of that bottom half, one of those bottom halves. So he rewrote it. It's not just Dave Miller, of course. Alexei Kuznetsov did a lot of this work, and this was called SoftNet. Some of you may have heard of SoftNet. And basically, what this did was, it took bottom halves and replaced them with a system called SoftIRQs. And a system layer on top of that called tasklets. And then bottom halves, the old style bottom halves were re-implemented on top of that. So, soft IRQs have really, really strong CPU affinity. And when you raise a soft IRQ, it gets executed on the CPU you raised it on, never any other. Another CPU may also raise a soft IRQ, and it will be handled on that CPU. It's totally per CPU. Any CPU can execute its soft IRQ. It's, as I said, it's completely tied to that soft IRQ. Contrasting that with tasklets, tasklets have weak CPU affinity in that they will prefer to run on the CPU that they are scheduled on. But if they're scheduled on one CPU, and then they're scheduled on a different CPU, they'll run on the first CPU. And this is actually a benefit. As a result of that, they can only run on one CPU at a time. So you can't, your tasklet is not multi-threaded. It's only running on one CPU at a time. Other tasklets can be running on other CPUs. So if you need to synchronize work between two tasklets, two independent tasklets, you've got to use locking. I don't believe anybody does this, and I can't think of any particular reason you'd want to. There's a fixed number of soft IRQs, up to 32. Right now we've got 6. If you want another one, you better have a really good reason. Whereas tasklets, you're encouraged to use them. Every driver should have a tasklet. Just contrasting this to the old style, they had no CPU affinity. Only one of them could run at a time, as I said earlier. And you also need special permission to get one of those, and that wasn't very good either. These are the interfaces to use the various different parts of bottom halves. If you ever saw Mark BH in the old style, that's probably now RaySoft IRQ, or maybe Tasklet Schedule if the bottom half's being converted to a Tasklet. We used to have all kinds of stuff that was bottom halves, serial, networking, SCSI. These days our soft IRQs are much more sensible and sane. Yes? They were re-implemented as a tasklet. And, well, actually, it's an array of tasklets. And each of these tasklets, before it was executed, would take the global bottom half lock. So this emulated the old semantics in that only one of them could run at a time. And obviously, it couldn't sleep anyway because it was in bottom half context. There's no problem with, you know, acquiring the spin lock. But of course, you know, it's still got all the old problems with being single-threaded. So there's no scalability. But equally, networking was now out from under this big global bottom half lock.
Yeah. So because sub-IRQ is to run on any number of CPUs at the same time, then you have to share half the available work between them.
Okay, the point was that the soft IRQs need to share out the work between them, and that's correct, that's exactly what they do. Every single soft IRQ implemented in the kernel today actually has a per CPU data field, and so they don't interfere with each other. That what happens is the interrupt comes in, it queues some work for the soft IRQ in the local CPU data structure, and then when the soft IRQ runs, it picks it back out of the local CPU data structure. So there's actually no locking going on. And the division of work is done automatically. One of the problems is that some architectures round-robin interrupts from any given device. Other architectures lock the interrupt to a specific CPU, and each of these behaviors can be a problem.
So, a packet,
that's correct. And if a packet comes in on a given CPU, it will then be handled by that CPU and that CPU alone. The hard IRQ will. That's correct.
Which ones are balanced? Which ones are the ones that was talking about balancing?
Okay, hard interrupts on x86, the default behavior of the IO APIC is to distribute interrupts to each CPU in a round robin fashion. This is actually not a good thing under some circumstances, and is a good thing under other situations. One of the problems with bottom halves is that theoretically we could get tied up doing an awful lot of processing at the bottom half level and never getting back to user space to say, hey, some data's arrived, do something with it. And really, user space is doing the interesting stuff. We're just trying to deliver stuff to the kernel, from the kernel to the user space. We're not doing anything interesting. So if we don't get the packet back up to user space, it's pointless having processed it. So what we do in an overload situation is we punt all the work up to a special kernel thread called ksoftirqd. And this has its own set of problems. I think that's probably because our condition for detecting overload is too eager, and we detect overload too rapidly. Nevertheless, it's the right thing to do in practice, because what will happen is soft IRQ processing will be deferred until the system's a bit less busy, and then we'll go and process it. And that may result in us dropping packets, if we're talking about a network still. But that's a good thing, because packets get retransmitted, and TCP has algorithms to detect that packets are being dropped, and it will slow down the sender, which is exactly what we want to do. So I'm going to leave bottom halves and go on to timers, but I'll be circling back to bottom halves in a bit. So any more questions about bottom halves for the moment? Yes. Sorry? They're kicked off by the architecture dependent assembly code. After it's handled an interrupt, it checks to see whether any soft IRQs are pending and will then go and call do soft IRQ. Okay, so timers. Way, way, way back in the day, Linux 2.0, we had old style timers. And old style timers, there were a fixed number of them, 32. Sound familiar? And they were used by the weirdest things. The 387 coprocessor used one. Half a dozen strange SCSI drivers used one each. They're gone. They're long gone. But they weren't actually ripped out until Linux 2.4. We're not very good at ripping out old cruft. But they're gone now. And so now we just have dynamic timers. And use them through the existing API of add timer, mod timer, del timer, which is great, except that del timer's racy. If you're on an SMP system and you call del timer won't return until it's finished executing on this CPU. It can't possibly be executing on this CPU, but it might be executing on that CPU over there. And so what del timer sync does is it goes and looks through all the other CPUs' lists of timers and makes sure it's not running on any of those, and won't return until it's stopped running. But if you need to acquire a lock in your timer handler and you're holding that lock when you call del timer sync, it will never finish running. So you've just locked up the box. If you go around and replace del timer with del timer sync without knowing what you're doing, you've traded a rather icky race for a definite lockup. So that's not a panacea at all. The del timer race, I put these in the wrong order. The del timer race is kind of interesting. This is taken from the 3C515 driver, because most of them have been audited already. And what happens is we go into cleanup module and we unregister the netdev. And that calls corkscrew close, which does a del timer. Now, if corkscrew timer is currently running on a different CPU, it happens to call add timer. Because we don't have a periodic timer, we don't have any periodic timers. These are one shot. It's do this work after time X. I'm sorry? Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like chaining ats rather than having cron. So if that's running on a different CPU at the time that del timer is called, it will add itself again after del timer has returned, saying, all done. And then we go in K3, the root corkscrew dev, which happens to contain VP. And at that point, we're pretty much sunk. And then the module exits. And even better, because now we're going to start calling into this code, which is no longer in a module. It's being used by nothing at the moment. The code's probably still there. It'll probably run a couple more times. Eventually, we'll go and overwrite it with something else. And at that point, your kernel's dead. These are really tricky races to fix, because you can't just go around and replace them with del timer sync. Typically, you have to go and audit it. And unfortunately, the del timer idiom was used in all the template drivers, because nobody figured out there's a race here until about 2.1.120 or so. It was discovered by Andrew Morton. I'm not sure how he discovered it. I think he just went and looked at it. He's got one of those kinds of brains that he can just see races. So going back, I said I'd be circling back to bottom halves later. and here we are. This is how timers used to be run in 2.4. We'd call DoSoftIRQ. DoSoftIRQ would call TaskletHighAction. So it'd start running a Tasklet. That would say, well, this is one of the bottom halves, and call BHAction. BHAction grabs the global BH log, if it can. Then it runs the timer bottom half. And that calls run timer list. And that actually finally gets around to calling your timer's function. An example of which would be the corkscrew timer function that I showed you on the previous page. And then, of course, it unlocks the global BH log. This was kind of inefficient, but it did preserve the guarantees that that only one timer would run at a time. And there was a really gross hack for networking, which guaranteed that old-style protocols would not race with any timers, because that would take the global BH lock as well. And that was a function called deliver to old ones. And that was quite an aptly named one. And I think that's finally gone. We don't support old ones anymore. But the work done in 2.5 actually simplified this quite a lot. Timers are now soft IRQs. And that means that timers can run on all CPUs at once and can race with any other bit of code in the kernel they want to. So if you've got a timer in your device driver, check its locking now before it's too late. Or in your file system, or in your SCSI subsystem, or anywhere you're using a timer, go check it. Check it's not going to race with anything else. Sorry, before I move on, any questions about timers? Task queues and work queues. Task queues have nothing to do with tasks. They're yet another way of doing work later. And the previous two it's been possible to do work later, but you're still in a fairly limited context. You can't sleep. You can't access a process's memory. You can't do anything terribly interesting. But the task queue, you could queue it for execution pretty much at any point you wanted to, and you could sleep. That's great. Kind of. Task queues were originally intended as a replacement for bottom halves because they were dynamically allocated and they could be called at any point, and it didn't quite work out that way. They got integrated as an accessory to the existing bottom half mechanism, which has now been replaced. There are some well-known task queues. TQ scheduler, it's not a task, but it can be scheduled. Well, no, not exactly. It was just run by the scheduler before it tried to schedule any tasks. It would run the scheduler task queue. That's gone. That went before 2.4. TQ timer, I hate. TQ immediate, I hate. The timer task queue would be run at the same time as the timers. So it was a way of deferring work till a little bit later, but not too much later. TQ immediate would be run upon exiting bottom half context. You'd be in you'd be in process context, so you could sleep, but you'd be sleeping in some random process's context. And that wasn't a terribly good idea at all, because random processes would have time taken away from them by other bits of the kernel. So if you say write a disk block out to disk and then wait for it in TQ immediate, whichever task was unlucky enough to get scheduled after it would have to wait for that disk to come, for that block to come back from disk. Not a good idea at all. And the TQ immediate, the interface for using it was awful. You would call qtask, and then you'd mark bh, bh immediate. And you'd think, well, why do I have to mark the bottom half? In fact, some people didn't mark the bottom half at all, and their task queue would only get run when somebody else got around to marking that bottom half to run. Fortunately, the interface got replaced with block run queues. Sorry, I've skipped a bit. I'm sorry. So that exposed internal implementation details. So we couldn't just go and rip out all the bottom halves because there are all these drivers using mark BH, and that was just wrong, because you know what do bottom halves have to do with task queues? That doesn't make any sense. Don't do that. TQ disk I also hate. TQ disk is, well, there was never any rule about exactly when you should call run task queue TQ disk. People just did it at various points. If you did it at the wrong point, or you didn't do it at the right point, performance would start to suck. And that's a kind of hard problem to debug. And that got replaced with block run queues. But it's still the case that you need to call it in the right place or performance will suck, and don't call it in the wrong place, otherwise performance will suck. And KEventD was introduced during 2.4, and that actually gave you a task of your own, somewhere where you could queue work to be done and sleep, and it wouldn't take time away from anybody else, it wouldn't unfairly penalize anybody else. We could all just go to that one task and everything would be good. Scheduled task was a nice name for it. Sorry? I thought I heard something. Okay. You could just, you know, schedule it. Unfortunately, there's only one K event D, so that forced everything onto one CPU, and it meant that if one task in this task queue was sleeping, nobody else could do anything else. So some people were planning on, you know, making one per CPU and, you know, all the other kind of good stuff. The Ningo came along, got rid of task queues. And we're left with work queues. Work queues made KEventD per CPU and completely changed the interface. It's now schedule work instead of schedule task. Schedule delayed work. This is great. Rather than setting a timer to, you know, put your task on the queue later, you can just do it directly. Schedule delayed work. They're not, work queues are not exact replacement for task queues. You could have custom task queues before. And with custom task queues, you could run them at any point you wanted to. RiseFS used to do stuff like this, I think, for its journal commit thread. It had a task queue, and it's just a, you know, it's a structure, and it would queue its own work into it, and then when it knew the time was right, it would run that task queue, and everything's being queued to it would be done. Gone. We don't have these things that we can do anymore, which is a bit of a loss, I think. I think we've lost some functionality there. Possibly we wanted to lose that functionality. I don't know. But we do have the ability to create custom work queues. And when you create a custom work queue, it creates a kernel thread for each CPU on your system. And that will run your work queue for it. And you queue work to it, and you know when that thread gets scheduled, it will execute that work. They're GPL only. I don't want to get into the politics of that here, but they are only available if your code is licensed under the GPL. Question? would I mind getting into the politics of it? Sure. Some people don't believe that GPL-only symbols are legally binding. I am not a lawyer. Some people feel that these facilities are generally useful to all kinds of people, even people who write binary and kernel modules. I don't know. why will I don't know. When Ingo created them, he said these are going to be used by GPL-only code. And since they're a new facility rather than a modification of an existing facility, Lena said okay. Oh, right, yes. Okay, I've gone a little bit too fast, clearly. You know about using export symbol to export functionality to modules. There's now an export symbol GPL, and there's the module loader enforces that only people who have a license that's GPL compatible in their code. There's a module license command statement, and if that's GPL or one of the licenses that's GPL compatible, it will be allowed to use the symbols that are marked as export symbol GPL, and otherwise it won't be allowed to. The link will fail, module load will fail. GPL or BSDAE or, yeah. Yes. A work queue creates a kernel thread for each CPU on the system. Why would you want a work queue instead of a kernel thread? Because the interfaces are easier. Ingo's done the hard work for you. It's all been done. All the signal blocking's been done for you. That's right, you will. You will have 32 threads on a 32 CPU system. But now we can handle a huge number of kernel threads. In the case people weren't aware, 2.5 can handle, 100,000 threads, no problem. Yes? When you queue work, that queues to the local task queue. I think there's also an interface to schedule work on a particular different CPU. I'm not quite sure how that's useful, but I think it is there. Yes, when you queue work, that does return immediately. You can call it from any context, it doesn't block, there's no memory allocation, you just queued your work. So when you continue processing, it just goes through the local. Yes, if you queue a lot of work to all by the same process, it's all scheduled to the local CPU, yes. There's no load balancing involved. If you call a function which sleeps, the worker thread for your CPU does sleep. And that's one reason you'd want to create a custom work queue rather than use the general work queues. If you know you're going to be calling a lot of sleeping functions and you might be sleeping for a long time, you can do that if you've got a custom work queue and you won't adversely affect anybody else in the system. Software RAID would, probably want to use a custom work queue. I don't know how much it does that's blocking and how much it just kicks off work and then goes to sleep for a bit, or kicks off work and doesn't actually wait for it. I think the question is more whether you want to have one thread per CPU or one thread per RAID device. For example, the SCSI error handling threads, there's one per SCSI interface, not per CPU. And that makes more sense for SCSI. Speaking of which, this is how I got involved. I was burbling about how silly it was that we still had the old star bottom halves and how we had 5 or 6 ways of doing the same thing and all these different layers. I mean, you saw how bad that timer call chain was. It's silly. it's silly to have call chains that deep. It's silly to still have the old cell bottom halves. And somebody said, well, why don't you do something about it then? So I did. First of all, I switched it from an old cell bottom half to a tasklet. And that was pretty straightforward. Converting from an old cell bottom half to a tasklet is pretty straightforward. A lot of the serial drivers still need that doing, but it's okay, it's doable. It's, you know, perhaps a 20-line diff, mostly just renaming stuff from underscore SCSI BH to SCSI tasklet. And part of the reason for doing it is, you know, I didn't see why SCSI should be serialized against, you know, the networking stack. Well, not networking stack, that's not serialized, against the serial drivers. And I started looking into SCSI in a fair amount of detail, see where it had locking and what it was locking, and was I breaking any assumptions by changing the rules about what else might be running? I decided, no, actually, it's fine. And then I looked at it some more. I was thinking, you know, networking doesn't use tasklets. Networking uses soft IRQs. Why doesn't SCSI use soft IRQs? I looked at it some more. I thought, you know, it probably should use a soft IRQ. I mean, you know, we've got, you know, on some people's machines, on Greg's machine, Greg's got lots and lots of SCSI adapters. Don't shake your head. I know you have. And so, you know, you've got, what, 16 SCSI adapters, and each one's triggering off interrupts. Why should these things be, you know, forced to run on only one CPU at a time? That's silly. Let's just do them all. Let's let them go on all CPUs all at once. Yeah! Because we've all got 16 CPUs to handle our 16 SCSI caps, right? So I turned into a soft IRQ, and I went and investigated the locking again, and it's pretty straightforward to do for SCSI, because SCSI's got locking everywhere. Like, the SCSI command queues are locked, the SCSI adapters are locked, and I think each SCSI disk has its own lock as well. It's wildly overlocked, and, you know, all the locking that was previously being done around it by the bottom half layer really wasn't necessary. This is a perfectly safe change to make for 2.4. Yeah, I know that's not happening. So I converted it to a soft IRQ, and that's the code that's currently in the kernel at the moment. I'm not entirely sure this is the right way of doing things, though. I think this isn't the right way of doing things because Alexey Kuznetsov doesn't think it's the right way of doing things. See, you can actually unload the SCSI module. You can't unload networking. Networking's built in. It's not a module. You've got to have networking. There's no actual way of unregistering the soft IRQs. Right. See, tasklets, you can use tasklet disable, you can use tasklet kill. Before you exit your module, you can be absolutely convinced that there's no tasklets running at all. Well, that your tasklet isn't running. So you can safely exit, you know you're not being called into by the kernel. There's only open soft IRQ. There's no closed soft IRQ. There's no way of safely unloading. It's probably safe, because if there's no... If there's still SCSI drivers loaded, then the SCSI subsystem can't be unloaded. So by the time it can be unloaded, there's probably nothing triggering interrupts, and therefore raising soft IRQs. But that's hard to be sure. So perhaps this isn't the right way of doing things. Another reason it might not be a good way of doing things was suggested to me by the NAPI work done recently. And what NAPI does, there's a bit of a problem with using soft IRQs. If you're on an x86 box and your IO apex delivering interrupts to each CPU in turn, then let's suppose someone ping floods your network card. Packet 1 goes to CPU 0. Packet 2, CPU 1. Packet 3, CPU 2. Packet 4, CPU 3. Packet 5, CPU 0. These are going to start interfering with each other because we've got spin locks, right? I mean, that's how we multi-threaded the thing. But they're all going to the same place. So they all hit the same spin lock. So all of a sudden, we've got one CPU in doing the work, and we've got three CPUs spinning, waiting for that lock. That's not very efficient. So what they do in NAPI, I got this wrong initially, and my misunderstanding of NAPI led to me thinking it has to do SCSI, but how NAPI actually works is it disables the interrupt on the card. So you get an interrupt, you disable it, you read the packet off the card, you go and process that packet. Interrupt on the card is still disabled. When you finish processing that packet, you go and check, are there any more packets? Did any arrive while I was still working on this? If so, you go and process them. If not, you re-enable the interrupt, and next time we go to CPU 1. But that's fine. It's a low-load situation. We're distributing them across the CPUs. But in a high-load situation, it's going to keep on coming. All the packets are going to be read off this card without any interrupts being taken, even. And that's a really cool thing to do. So what I thought it did was that it had one tasklet per network card. And in fact, this is what I'm planning on doing for SCSI at some point. If we have one tasklet per SCSI card, then all interrupts are going to go to those tasklets, right? Because it doesn't matter which CPU your hard interrupt came in on. If you schedule the tasklet on the second CPU, it just runs on the first one instead. So, you know, localization of work set. Yeah, that kind of thing. Hang on. I wrote it down. Affinity, CPU affinity. You get strong CPU affinity for the SCSI cards. And that's probably the way I'm going to take it in the future. So we'll have one tasklet for each SCSI card. And that way, we won't get any contention on the different spin locks. And that's probably a good thing. Now, IDE. I looked at doing IDE this way, and then I ran away. Alan said, this is harder than it looks. And I said, and he said, no, you don't understand. These people don't read the specs that they're writing, they're designing devices for. IDE does all kinds of horrific locking and unlocking, and you've seen HD Palm, the number of options it's got. One of them is unmask interrupts while you're processing, and that's doing most of what you'd get from doing the from converting to a tasklet soft IRQ. And frankly, I want to stay outside the radius of blame for IDE. I don't want to be the one who people come running to and say, my IDE, I just ate all my data. So, any questions? Yes. I'm sorry? The old solid bottom halves are already removed. I started on this, you know, trying to take things out from underneath the global BH lock until eventually there'd be nothing left and then we could kill it. Well, I'm no Ingo Molnar. He can submit patches that just take it all away and break dozens of drivers and Linus takes the patch. So he did. But, you know, Ingo's got better reasons than I do. You know, he says, well, if we take away this, then we can optimize this, 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 and this. And then he said, great. Whereas me, it was just, well, you know, I don't think it should look like this. I think this is crap. I think this is ugly. So, sure. So the old style bottom halves are already gone. And in fact, the patch which took the timers from out from underneath the bottom half lock replaced it with an array of tasklets, one for each CPU. I looked at that and said, this is crazy. This is exactly what a soft IRQ does. You've just done it as an array of tasklets. And they kind of hemmed and hawed, said, well, yeah, you're right. I mean, times are important enough that we do need one per CPU. So, yeah, okay, well, we'll allocate you a soft IRQ to do timers. That's in the paper. The highest priority soft IRQ is the high priority tasklets. They get run first. Then timers, then network transmit, network receive, SCSI, and then low priority tasklets. You can schedule tasklets as either high or low priority. If they're high priority, make sure they're fast. Make sure they really are going to execute fast, or they need the interrupt latency. There's some discussion about the relative orders of high priority tasklets versus timers. George Anzinger has a patch which introduces high resolution timers, and with that patch, he really wants the exact latency. He wants the best latency he can get. So he wants timers to run before them. I want it the other way around. I've won for the moment. We'll see. Yes. I have to finish now. Thank you all for coming.